Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We are living in a moment when the crucial issues of race and racism in the United States have once more gripped the national consciousness. As unarmed African Americans are gunned down by police and white vigilantes, with few, if any, consequences, the need for a serious reckoning is absolutely urgent. Black lives do matter, and while the insistence of that message is perhaps being heard, the question remains, what is being done about it? How much of our current state of affairs is rooted in history and even an erasure of history? Well, joining me to discuss those questions is my guest, Randall Robinson. He's a professor of law at Pennsylvania State School and Law School and is the creator, co-producer, and host of the public television human rights series World on Trial. He's also the founder of Trans Africa. He's written multiple national best-selling books, including The Debt, What America Owes to Blacks, The Reckoning, What Blacks Owe to Each Other, Quitting America, The Departure of a Black Man from His Native Land, and An Unbroken Agony, Haiti, From Revolution to the Kidnapping of a President. His latest book is a historical novel called Makeda, about a young black man coming of age during the civil rights movement and the spiritual connection he has to his grandmother. Professor Robinson lives in St. Kitts, West Indies, but he is currently visiting Los Angeles where this program is recorded, and I'm so pleased and honored to host him in studio for the hour. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. It's very sad that my first question to you today is to reflect on this horrific massacre at this church in South Carolina. I was grief-stricken this morning to read this news of what can only be described as an act of terrorism. And yet, the furthest that media are going is calling it a hate crime, which obviously it is as well. But what are your thoughts? The dead haven't even been buried yet, so I know it's very, very soon. But what are your thoughts on what has just happened?
When I read the story in the New York Times this morning, I was almost speechless. I didn't know how to respond, how to put my arms around what had happened. And I recalled a discussion I had had just a few years ago after President Obama was elected from a publisher that we needn't talk about some of the things that I had been writing about because we were in a post-racial period, which was on its face a silly claim, but one had hoped and prayed that we had gotten beyond tragedies like that occurred in that church, the church founded with others by Denmark Vesey, who was executed for the slave revolt that he helped to stage. And now to see this happen in 2015 is simply shocking, and we're all grief-stricken. But in the last analysis, the question is, what do we do about it? How do we respond to it? And we have formed, I think, as a society, a terrible habit of creating wreckage of a people, doing systemic a damage over, like the damage of slavery, over 246 years, and simply walking away from the crime against humanity, as if people who have been eviscerated could get up healthily and walk on competitively into a new time. That doesn't happen when you damage people like that. And we tend to press countries like Turkey that genocidally killed in 2015 a million and a half Armenians, saying that because Turkey hides from that. But Turkey doesn't hide from that any more than we hide from our own record with respect to what we have done to people in our own country. And we simply walk away from it, saying that was then, this is now, and we're moving on.
But what's really sad is what was done wasn't just not dealt with, but to a lesser extent continues today, right? So if we see mass incarceration as slavery, and if we see these shootings, I mean, this man who shot these nine people in this church reportedly said, quote, "You rape our women and you're taking over the country. You have to go." You could turn that right around. Yeah. Who's raping whom? Who's taking over? Yeah. And also, it's really sad because the killings of we have a Wild West situation today where police and white vigilantes are targeting unarmed African Americans, innocent people. And shouldn't that be seen as a continuation, as if that never really ended?
No question it is, and it is that. But for those who write history, they end it, and the other simply becomes an unrelated episode,
right,
as it continues without relation to what had happened previously. I mean, we had a kind of de facto slavery in the 20th century, a continuation of the formal slavery.
Yeah.
And so it's happening all over again.
The one of the worst incidents during the beginning of the civil rights movement was the bombing of the church in Birmingham, Alabama.
Sure.
Four little black girls were killed. This church shooting, more than twice that number.
That's
in
right.
2015.
In 2015.
And South Carolina has many operating active white supremacist groups, and we see that even police departments that employ members of some of these groups don't always immediately come out and denounce that and say, no, you cannot be a member of a police department designed to protect and serve while also being a member of a white supremacist hate group. And so how do you see police? How do we see police in that long arc of history?
Well, first of all, about Charleston. Charleston had the largest slave market in the country. New York City had the second largest slave market in the country. During 17th century, 20% of New York's population were slaves. But Charleston has had a long record of commercial, industrial enslavement of people. We were in the South. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, during segregation. We were afraid of the police. We had two black policemen who had just been permitted. They had to be college graduates. Nobody else did. But they couldn't arrest white people. When white police came around, we were afraid of them. And that hasn't changed. That they're not, we don't assume that they're there, at least, to protect and serve. Where do you turn when civilians like this do this sort of thing? You can't safely and with confidence call the police.
Yeah.
They're part of the way you perceive it, the same sort of implacable enemy.
So, Randall Robinson, you founded TransAfrica, and you've been someone with a very strong sense of transnational politics. And the other disaster unfolding this week is happening in Haiti, or just outside Haiti. And I'm wondering if you can, and you wrote a book about Haiti, An Unbroken Agony, Haiti from Revolution to the Kidnapping of a President. Hundreds of thousands of Haitian immigrant workers in the Dominican Republic are right now facing deportation, many of them children born in the Dominican Republic to Haitians, and most likely they are being deported as we speak. It has only just now sort of started emerging in the news after it was ignored for a long time. There was just one article in The Nation for about a little over a week about it. Is this an issue that we should also be seeing through race, slavery, and history?
It is an issue. It has been an issue for a very long time. Haitians have been treated criminally in the Dominican Republic. Many who have gone there, born there, have been expelled. They don't have, they're not awarded any citizenship rights in the Dominican Republic. Virtually all of it is color-based in the Dominican Republic. And the way we have responded to Haiti over a terribly long period of time is it's as if we never stopped punishing the Haitian people
for liberating themselves
for their revolution.
Yeah,
and it even in this country. Danny Glover has been trying for the longest time to make the Toussaint Louverture movie. The only successful slave revolt in this hemisphere that occurred in the late 1700s, where they fought for 9 years or so and won their freedom, sent Napoleon packing back to France, having sold the Louisiana Territory to the United States because he had had enough of this beaten and whipped. After two armies from France had tried to beat back this revolt, one from Spain, another from Britain, and they prevailed. And what did they get? Sanctions from the entire world, including the Vatican. The Vatican sanctions staying in place until the Emancipation Proclamation in the United States. It's a terrible record on this sort of thing, and it's one of the great historic stories. And sadly, we so successfully suppress truth in the United States. I think we live in a free society, a free information society. Yeah. I went to Jamaica some years ago to address some high school students and talk to them about a range of things. And I asked if, because we wouldn't be free in the United States. I mean, it accelerated the emancipation process
in the
U.S.
Revolution.
Yes, mm-hmm. All across the hemisphere and in the United States and in Britain.
And that's a huge part of history we don't hear about.
And so I ask these Jamaicans who were beneficiaries of this, in much the same way Americans who don't know anything about it, who were beneficiaries of this, I ask them, how many of them, 200 Jamaican high school students, how many of you have ever heard of Toussaint Louverture?
Mm.
Not a hand went up. Mm. Said, how many of you have ever heard of Snoop Dogg?
Oh.
Everybody's
hand went
up. And so that was the impetus for writing Makeda.
Mm. Which I want to get to in detail.
If you don't know your story, you can't know who you are. And we've not been allowed to know our story before. Most of us don't think we have one before slavery. And so all of our history dates from slavery forward. But what about all of the millennia before that? We don't know a thing about it. Right. And that's not an accident, because if you can strip a people of their story, they become a very malleable people.
Yeah. I want to talk about your historical novel, Makeda, after we go to break a little bit later in the program, but staying on Haiti for a little bit. It's been 11 years since the 2004 U.S.-backed coup that ousted the democratically elected leader Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and your book on Haiti focused on this. And taking the long view, you know, it's been several years since you wrote that book as well. How much of today's suffering in Haiti, and I'm not just talking about the migrant crisis in the Dominican Republic, but even just the state of Haiti today, how much of it can be traced to that coup?
Oh, I think virtually all of it can. President Aristide was a great democratic, compassionate figure in Haiti, a popular figure in Haiti. His party is the largest party in the country. The party has been banned from participating in the election, so that if you ban that party, you can't say that you have
the
democracy.
Party.
Yes, Levalos, you're not a democratic country if you ban people from participating in the election process. Martelly, the head of state, has pushed the parliament to a side. He's governing alone by fiat.
Right. And then he's considered a U.S. ally, of course.
Similar tactics
elsewhere in countries and that so the U.S.
now
isn't
we
happy
have,
with are conceded as undemocratic.
We have Haiti under U.N. Occupation.
Yeah.
And under that occupation, Haiti is mineral-rich and resource-rich. $500 million in gold has been mined and secreted out of the country. Nobody knows. $50 million, or so, $41 million in silver has been absconded with.
Wow.
in the same fashion. The Clinton Foundation has raised all sorts of money. People are protesting in front of Clinton offices in New York. Haitians are saying that the wealthy have benefited, the foreign investors have benefited, but the people in whose names and for whose cause this money was raised haven't received anything.
To that same effect, the International Red Cross came under fire as well.
$500 million they have raised, and they've built six homes.
The ProPublica and NPR found that they did an investigative report. Instead of 130,000 homes that they claimed that they essentially, you know, created to house Haitians, they've only built six. So has Haiti also become, because you sort of see these twin efforts elsewhere as well. You see the sucking out of natural resources, and you see the influx of charitable institutions. So charity becomes the lens through which we see these countries. But then, of course, even that is simply another way to push money to the top. It's seen as Haiti has become a cash cow like other countries.
We call those people the Savior Brigade. They come into countries, the show and pens, come into to countries saying that they've come to do good, and they almost invariably stay to do well.
Hmm.
And that can be most Haitians, or many Haitians, to safely say, believe that Bill Clinton is there to make money.
Yeah.
And nothing has come of these efforts. And all of this money raised by a compassionate, giving public in the world,
right,
has gone largely disappeared into the pockets of people who've given no accounting of what that money has been spent for. But it hasn't been applied to Haiti's grave situation.
Right, and of course the earthquake from 5 years ago has contributed hugely to that. And when that earthquake happened, the 2010 devastating earthquake, people gave in droves, generously believing that their dollars would go help ordinary
200,000 people died in that quake, and they have been betrayed.
Yeah. Now I'm wondering if you don't live in the United States anymore full time, and you wrote a book about that, Quitting America: The Departure of a Black Man from His Native Land. And I want to talk to you about that aspect a little bit later. But from the outside looking in the United States over the past year, as this very high profile movement has emerged to talk about an issue, of course, that's not new, but that is perhaps better documented than before, the Black Lives Matter movement, shining a light on police violence against African Americans. How do you view that from outside? How is that being seen? Are people excited that there is a high-profile movement that might be getting finally some attention drawn to this very important issue?
I think so.
Yeah.
There is, in human rights, international human rights, that I teach at Penn State Law, the sort of pillar human right is the right to life. which means that every life matters in the international human rights community. This is a part of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, that every life counts. A life that is taken in this way, particularly by an agency of government, becomes an international crime, a violation of the covenant that the U.S. ratified and nations around the world ratified to ensure that all people have a case to make to establish courts to defend this, the most basic of all human rights, the right to life.
And we don't see that kind of accountability in our current court system at all. I mean, here in Southern California and Los Angeles, activists of the Black Lives Matter movement have been trying to hold our local police chief accountable, attending meetings of the police commission. And, you know, we see that all over the country in New York and Baltimore, where, in fact, Baltimore may be the only place where police may start to, if we're lucky, see some consequences simply because they were indicted and charged. Still, of course, no convictions. And how does that lack of accountability just fuel what is seen as an open season on African Americans?
One also is cause to think that were it not for the camera.
Yes.
and that maybe this is not any kind of special surge, that this is what has been happening all along.
In the past, we've just accepted the police narrative. Not we as a society, have accepted the police narrative. He reached for my gun. He aggressively approached me. I had no choice but to shoot because there was just no documentary evidence except for the word of people.
We ought to call to public account why and how police agencies do what they do. How do we screen people to become policemen in our country? What are the psychological markers that we look for to demonstrate and to show that this person shouldn't be eligible to become a policeman? Because they are obviously a good policeman and decent people who are trying to protect people. But there are a very many bad apples who apparently think nothing of the fellow who shot the man in the back who was running away.
Yeah, Walter Scott.
Yes, and
I mean, but if there are so many bad apples, one wonders how rotten the entire barrel is.
Well, yeah, you can't know until you explore the barrel. And but there doesn't seem to be any rush to do that.
Right. So I want to finally, before we go to a quick break, also ask you about the fact that we can't just, this isn't just an issue of black versus white. This is an issue of a particular system, because in this movement to hold police accountable, of course, we've seen plenty of black and brown officers who have been among the perpetrators of violence. So how do we critique, I think, what many people call a system of white supremacy? Not that it's just white officers or white vigilantes. In the case of the vigilantes, they seem to be mostly white, although George Zimmerman was technically not. How do we explain or understand? What's the framework that we can use to understand the violence facing African Americans?
Well, I think it's more complicated than we think it may be. It's mm-hmm. not simply a case of black and white, mm-hmm. That all of us are good and all of them are bad. It doesn't work that way. There are overlapping psychologies, and there are people who would have the same sort of emotional and psychological profile, notwithstanding race, who should be ineligible to be police officers. And the police agencies seem to become some sort of run-amok fraternity, where the...
A gang, should we say?
Well, you could say that. I don't want to overcharge the atmosphere on this thing. But yes, and so you have to look at it like that. I think looking at it only through the lens of race will give you a false reading.
Yeah. And of course, there's always history. We come back to history. And in the second part of our interview after this break, I want to talk about the way in which you have attempted through your latest book, which is a novel, to bring the backdrop of history. This is Uprising. We're going to take a short break. I'm speaking with Professor Randall Robinson. He's joining us in studio for the hour. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We turn back now to Professor Randall Robinson. He's a professor of law at Penn State University Law School. He is the founder of Trans Africa. He has written a number of best-selling books. His latest book is a novel. It's a historical fiction novel, and it's called Makeda. And that's what I want to turn to next. Professor Robinson, this book that you wrote, it's been out for a couple of years. This is a book that, unlike your earlier books, is a work of fiction within a world that is historically accurate. I understand you did a lot of research to preserve the backdrop as accurate. First, why did you turn to fiction after so many nonfiction books?
Well, I thought it had greater elasticity in the sense that you could tell a larger story that needs to be told than you could through nonfiction. We have two kinds of barriers that face us. One is the crippling debilitation of a people who had been enslaved for 246 years, followed on with other kinds of de facto slavery sort of obstacles to surmount. But that's one. Those things were right before you. You could put your arms around them. They were legal and illegal. They were quantifiable. That was that. But we had a bigger problem. And the bigger problem was that we needed to be able to measure what we had lost. We had lost what people cannot survive so easily. One, we had lost our language, we had lost our religions, we had lost our culture, we had lost our mores, we had lost any idea of who we had been and therefore who we were.
You're speaking in terms of how African Americans today, the farthest back they can trace their ancestry might be to their grandparents or great-grandparents.
That's right.
And then beyond that, there's a sort of a blankness.
We can't see beyond the wall of slavery.
Right. So which state or country in Africa their ancestors might have come from is really hard to trace.
Really don't know.
And why is that a tragedy? Why does that cripple a person?
And Africa has been defaced in the sense that, we had a withering storm as a child of Tarzan movies during my childhood. And so you were given a terrible picture of Africa, even while it was under colonial occupation, where Africa lost its sense of things as well, is eviscerated by the colonial powers. And so I thought I would write a book about a blind laundress in Richmond, Virginia, a grandmother who has this special relationship with her grandson. And it's a love story. It's a love of a grandmother for her grandson. It's a love of this grandson grown up for his wife. But essentially, it's in a larger way a love of black people rekindle for themselves. And she tells him about lives she had lived in the centuries before. And she swears him to secrecy. You must never tell anybody this. And this is evidenced by actual stories of things that have happened to people, a woman born in the Depression in Chicago, who remembered being before the Inquisition in Spain in the 1580s and said there were not two inquisitors, but there were not three, but two, and named them. A working class woman in Chicago never left the country, and they went to the archives of the small town and investigated this, and they opened the books and found that she was right. And so, as someone says, the only people in the world who don't believe in reincarnation are a few people in Britain. But everybody else does. And in any case, she had lived these lives. And so she was there when 5,000 years ago, when the Great Pyramid was built.
So this is the grandmother in your book, a woman who went by the name Maddie, but then said her real name was Makeda.
Her real name was Makeda, and her mother told her not to call herself that because she'd never get a job in Richmond, Virginia, which was right. With a strange name like that. The grandson had never heard a name like that. Right. Where does this name come from? Which you learn later down the trail in the book where the name comes from. But she has lived all of these great lives. And in these lives, she had seen black people in a higher place, a much higher place.
So the early days of Christianity and royalty?
She was there when the churches were consecrated at Lalibela, 1,100 years after the birth of Christ. These churches carved out of solid rock in Lalibela with tunnels connecting them. But she was there 5,000 years ago when the great pyramids were built.
So this grandmother has these memories of a previous life that offer her a glimpse into history that her contemporaries don't have access
to.
And she relates the stories to her grandson, a young man named Gray March,
yes,
who wants to be a writer. But his life also unfolds at a very historic time in the U.S. in the 50s and early 60s as the civil rights movement starts. And so so Makeda's dreams sort of represent this lost collective memory of African Americans. How important is history to a people, not just personal history, but a collective history?
As an African proverb, the way out is the way back through. You have to know who you were to know who you are. And African religions, West African religions, hold that your ancestors never died. They're always there with you in spirit. And they're not boxed in a church, but they're in the air, they're in the flowers, they're in the trees, they're everywhere. And so she sort of gives him this kind of sense of spirituality and the sense of history.
And dignity?
And dignity, and it gives him a towering confidence that maybe I am really something larger than I thought, because I had been diminished by these conditions that wall me in, that I can't see beyond to think that there's anything more. Is that why the film Toussaint L'Ouverture has never been made?
Because knowing that history can be very powerful and dangerous to the establishment.
Could that be a greater story than the story of the Haitian Revolution? And so everybody, even in the Caribbean, now may easily think that Haiti's a disaster and not know that it was a planned disaster by some of those people who are down there now.
And you know, this is an important discussion that happens in academia as well, the importance of ethnic studies, the importance of African-American studies for other minorities, for example, the importance of Chicano studies, and which, of course, being eviscerated, these departments in universities where professors help students dig into their own sort of historical legacy, these are being underfunded, they're being cut, and of course there's a reason for that, because knowing that history empowers you. So I'm wondering what you think about the fact that we also have, at this time, still no reckoning of even our later history. And this goes back to your book, Debt. In fact, on the issue of reparations for slavery, we still don't really like to even talk about it. But in Chicago recently, there was a city council decision that created a fund for reparations for African-American victims of police torture and abuse. It was the first time that the word reparations had been used. How important is that?
Great step in the right direction.
We're afraid of that word.
We have supported, Bill Clinton supported reparations to forced labor visited upon Jews who were forced to work in the Volkswagen plants. We've had reparations for Japanese Americans who, as you know, were imprisoned during World War II. We've supported reparations in many places. But on the issue for which America has responsibility, that American state institutions benefited from, American private corporations benefited from. My law school, Harvard Law School, was founded on this. Isaac Royale founded Harvard Law School with the proceeds of monies he received from the sale of slaves in Antigua. But then the story's gone, the door shut, and you don't look back,
right.
And we're not to know what happened.
So if people are told, here's your freedom, that's the best, that's the only reparation you'll get, go on as if nothing happened.
It's like putting, look, you're on the starting line, but you've had both of your legs shot off. When we sound the gun, run and catch up. You can never catch up. You're not supposed to catch up. And so why don't we have our own truth commission? Why don't we simply ventilate and talk about what we have done, not just here, but in the world? Why don't we encourage that for all nations to clear the books and for once tell the truth about what has happened?
I have to say, your book, Debt, was very important in my own political education. And I recall many years ago, maybe a couple decades ago, or probably about 15 years ago, listening to your interview on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, before I was a journalist myself, before I was here at KPFK, and calling the station and pledging to the station to get a copy of that book as a thank you gift. Because it is something that is unsaid, but once is said, is so obvious that it makes you wonder why this is not just a topic of discussion, but a topic of action. Because that reckoning, that historical reckoning, again, just is being ignored. We took a small digression to reparations, but I do want to turn back to Makeda, your novel, because one of the things that fascinated me so much about it was that history that we don't hear about enough, the history of early Christianity, the history of just 1,000 years ago on the African continent. Where is that history accessible? How did you get a hold of it? How did you know to write about it? Where did you dig to get those to paint those pictures?
There are sources. They're well hidden. Writers have done this and put those things together, but it can be found, and the book has a bibliography in the back of it. It can be discovered easily enough, but one can be easily distracted from what you ought to look at when so many other things are given to you to distract your attention. So it's there, and it will make us feel so good about ourselves.
And some of that history was from West Africa, from Mali.
Yes. I mean, when I was a child in Richmond, Virginia, people had this expression, from here to Timbuktu. Nobody knew where Timbuktu was or what it was. Timbuktu was one of the world's greatest centers of scholarship. In the 13th, 14th centuries, the manuscripts are all there in Timbuktu, the venue of the world's first standing university was in Timbuktu. We knew nothing about it. When they had a movie in my childhood called The Queen of Sheba, and we didn't know where Sheba was, but this was about the Queen of Sheba. We didn't know that Sheba was Ethiopia. Nothing about that. And so the role was played by Gina Lola Brigida, an Italian actress. And we were given to believe that this prosperous nation, this throne, this royalty, this woman who had visited King Solomon in Jerusalem, we were given to believe she was white.
Right, or Elizabeth Taylor playing Cleopatra, the Queen
yes.
of Egypt.
Or the pharaohs being... Being
and
Arabs,
by the way,
that
depiction is still continuing in Hollywood today.
The Arabs
sadly.
Didn't come to North Africa until the 7th century. Yeah. We're talking about 5,000 years ago, and it is clearly established now that pharaohs Nama, Cheops, and Mentuhotep were black.
Mm. How does it make you feel when you discover this history? What goes through your mind?
It was renewing, and alloyed by a kind of small anger that this story had been kept from me all my life. These, in my education as a small child, particularly during segregation, were things that I needed to know. But I was not allowed to know these things. And we present ourselves as a free information society. We are not.
And today's young folks need to know their history so desperately as well.
Absolutely.
And are not necessarily getting it. You
need to be joined to a tradition.
I should mention your book again. It's called Makeda, M-A-K-E-D-A. Michael Eric Dyson compared your prose to a blend of Virginia Woolf, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and Toni Morrison. That's high praise. And, of course, I hope that there are more novels forthcoming.
I would like to, and I would like to think that's in the offing. So.
Let's spend the last few minutes of this conversation talking about the fact that you do live, I believe, at least part of the year in St. Kitts in the West
all
Indies.
All of the year.
It's
our permanent home.
It's your permanent home. You left the United States, which is what makes this conversation all the more important for me that I managed to catch you while you were in L.A. And you wrote a book, Quitting America, The Departure of a Black Man from His Native Land. How does the U.S. appear from the Caribbean today with our first black president? I mean, you mentioned Obama and post-racialism earlier in our conversation. Many people have been utterly disappointed by President Obama.
Well,
the inside, perhaps the outside.
I think in some ways that is naive as well. Mm-hmm. I have been disappointed, but I try to measure that. One can become president. That doesn't mean you're all powerful. He has limits. He lives in a small room. And he has been subjected to more criticism and attack, some of it purely racial,
of course,
than any president in the country's history, even being blamed for the debacle of Iraq, the dumbest George Bush decision that any president has ever made in American history. But Bush is enjoying good poll numbers now, and Obama's not, or 50-50. But while there's disappointment, perhaps our hopes and expectations should have been more measured in the first place.
A president can only do so much.
A
president will continue the legacy of what presidents do, which is imperialist actions.
Yes. The point is that we do live in, like it or not, an imperial country. We have the largest military footprint on the world of any country, perhaps in history. I'm not surprised. I think it was another part of your question.
Just being from the outside looking in.
Well, but I live in the tiniest nation in the Western Hemisphere. We have 35,000 people.
Wow.
And I love it. I was going somewhere as much as I was leaving somewhere. My wife, Hazel, is from St. Kitts. It has been an exquisite part of my life. Penn State called me and asked Dean Philip McConaughey, asked if I would come and teach. And I said, not if I have to leave St. Kitts. And he said, we can get around that. And we use Video Bridge, and I come up from time to time. And
wow.
Do it.
You teach your class electronically?
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's been a great experience because it's given me a chance to teach human rights, to be in contact with students, and to start this new program, The World on Trial, in which we put nations on trial to see if they have complied with the international human rights laws that they ratified. The world put these laws in place after World War II. Because the world was horrified by the photos coming out of the Nazi death camps. And so we put this new corpus of law in place, and nations around the world ratified these laws, including the United States. And so this program brings together the best lawyers, the best judges, the best witnesses around the world, with juries sitting and watching the trial as it occurs in law schools around the world, and voting, and then we ask the public to vote.
It's called The World on Trial.
The World on Trial.
And where can people watch it?
Well, they can go to their websites and its website rather, and find it. But they can view this weekend. It will be aired, or the Tavis Smiley show talking about it will be aired this weekend. And the show itself is being aired in special markets around the country during the months of June and July. This is a trial of the United States for the drone killings of people in Yemen.
Oh, excellent. So a very, very important
the question
program.
Is, did the U.S. violate the right to life of the covenant that we ratified?
Well, I certainly look forward to that. I want to thank you so much for spending this hour with me.
Oh, thanks for having me. I've enjoyed it.
My guest, Randall Robinson, is a professor of law at Pennsylvania State Law School and the creator, co-producer, and host of the public television human rights series World on Trial. He's also the founder of Trans Africa. He's written multiple national best-selling books, including The Debt, What America Owes to Blacks, The Reckoning, What Blacks Owe to Each Other, Quitting America, The Departure of a Black Man from His Native Land, and An Unbroken Agony, Haiti, From Revolution to the Kidnapping of a President. His latest book is a historical novel called Bakeda. And he is currently living in St. Kitts, West Indies, visiting Los Angeles, where this program is based.